Hello, friends. Welcome to The Resonance Test. I'm your host, Allison Coton, a director of innovation consulting at EPAM Continuum. As generative AI proliferates, the law is evolving too, asking questions that bring a uniquely philosophical lens to a typically tech-driven discourse. We've moved beyond wondering what can be built to questioning how generative AI could impact some of our most fundamental rights. What does the right to ownership of our data mean when AI is amalgamating our histories to create synthetic personas and projections? What does the right to privacy look like in a world where cameras recognize our faces and smart databases can forecast our behavior? How can we understand fairness, equity, and empathy in transactions where a human's decision-making is mediated by an algorithm's recommendations? Martin Lopatka, Managing Principal AI Consulting at EPAM, and David Gudis, partner at INQ Law, argue that this questioning is critical as Gen AI use cases reach further and deeper into our daily dealings. While we celebrate new efficiencies, we can't pause on the important work of considering how to build systems that are ethical, equitable, and transparent. If we can't trust that every AI creator has our best interests at heart, or even that a system is free from bias, we should be able to trust that the laws that protect us are enforced by people who have thought deeply about the human side of all this data we generate.
Hi, David. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Cool. So I thought we would have a conversation today about some of the recent developments, both from the technology and let's say, regulatory and compliance legal perspective around the crazy fast evolution of AI and generative AI in particular. And I guess actually a great place to start would be like sort of what's top of mind for you today?
Top of mind? Well, I kind of like to start from the beginning in terms of like the fundamentals, like what is AI? Sort of stepping back, what is AI? Sure, everyone's talking about it, but let's define some of our terms. So a recent definition of AI that's appeared in Canadian draft legislation to regulate AI, more about that later, AI or an AI system means a system that uses a model to make inferences to generate output, including predictions, recommendations, or decisions. So that's kind of our starting point when we talk about what is AI. And then maybe to jump ahead a little bit, that draft legislation also talks about what is harm, because when we talk about regulating AI, what we're trying to do is minimize harm or avoid harm. So I think it's kind of interesting. The legislation defines harm as physical or psychological harm, and we can explore that a little bit later. Damage to a person's property, I suppose that can include intellectual property. And third, any economic loss to a person. So that's sort of our starting point. What is AI? What is harm? And that's really going to kind of be the foundation for some of our discussions later today.
Neat. It's actually a great starting point. I've been thinking a lot recently, like very recently, around the differentiation between AI systems intended and designed to be fully autonomous versus this, I would say, more exciting and like more familiar subset of AI and generative AI products that are intended to be sort of symbiotic, right? Assistive systems where the technology component is intended to interface with like a human user. The added complexity of the fact that humans are diverse, like users of these systems are diverse. And so I like that your definition of the AI itself immediately cuts to sort of that question, right? What do you think in terms of whether there should be a differentiation in the way that we legislate fully autonomous systems that are just part of automated pipelines, like decisions get made, optimizations occur within large organizations. I'm thinking things like banks, energy grids, etc., versus systems where AI and human users are inherently symbiotic. Like the design is intended to augment human reasoning or activities in any way.
Right. That's a really important distinction. And some of the, you know, because I'm a lawyer, I look at some of the legal cases that have come out of AI, AI sort of controversies, if you will, or disputes. Yeah, they're some of these decisions do highlight the distinction and say, you know, essentially we're less concerned about AI systems that assist humans. So, for example, a human's making a decision about me that might affect me. I'm probably okay if that human says, "Hey, I've got an AI system that's gonna assist me, that's gonna make me do my job better, as maybe it's gonna speed up a decision. I can get a decision in a week instead of 6 months or a year. Oh, that's great." But I'm comforted by the fact that at the end of the day, the human's making a decision about me. The human's not sort of handing over to this AI system saying, "Hey, AI system, go ahead, make that decision about David. Can he get the bank loan? Yes or no?" Yeah, it's back to, well, if it's a human that's deciding using an AI tool to help them, you know, understand the data and analyze the data, that's fine, or to write a decision. So that is a huge distinction that we need to think about, the AI as a tool to help humans versus, as you say, an autonomous AI system where the human element is perhaps not even there.
That's great. You got me thinking a little bit about, it's a little bit, the inverse is, I would say, true for myself. I feel like putting a human in the loop can often be sort of like a way to shunt off responsibility for inherent choices that are made in the way that AI systems are designed. And I wonder if more scrutiny needs to be placed on things like the specifically the design of systems that are presenting results to human decision makers, right? And what is the responsibility from the technology perspective? So what do we need to see in terms of due diligence that a system is not sort of optimizing on an outcome that really isn't appropriate, given that there's a human in the loop and largely being, it's a bit strong language, but I would say almost a scapegoat in some cases, right? Where how much can you expect, how much oversight can you expect from an individual interacting with an AI system, in terms of unbiased or fair decision making, when exactly as you say, some of the upside there is that we're reducing the amount of cognitive load on the human. That's the efficiency gain, right? So people can't really make decisions on what they don't see, and there's a risk there, I think. Have you encountered anything in the legal domain to speak to that risk specifically?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's a good point. The idea that a human is part of the loop, is part of the decision-making process in and of itself isn't, well, we're fine because a human was part of this, so we really needn't worry. But I think what you're pointing to is, well, maybe not, and we need to look deeper. And is this AI system, you know, the positive would be, oh, it's just a tool to help us be more efficient, or is it really, in a way, steering that human towards a result that's biased? That's inherently biased or based on faulty data, these kinds of things. So, right, having a human in the loop isn't enough, but it's a step towards saying, well, maybe there is accountability, and maybe we're less worried about the impact. But you're absolutely right. We also need to examine, how is that system operating, and is it, sure, we can say, well, it's not really making a decision, but it's steering that decision or influencing the decision in a way that maybe we're not comfortable with.
And I think it's funny. I 100% agree. And yet, at the same time, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I think that I've heard a similar sort of conversational line around things as simple as, like, let's say before everything became very easy to put an AI tag on, but in terms of things like search results, right? Like what you if a search result from, you know, any major search provider is complete in terms of making sure that coverage across an unbiased selection of sources is always represented, does does the inherent bias of what's visible in the first end results really have an impact? And then studying the interaction between humans and those sort of automated information processing systems, AI being a subset of that, we know that the deeper down that list you go, the less likely anyone is ever going to see it. So is it fair
That's
to
right.
say that it's actually been surfaced for that human in the loop? I'd be very curious to know if there's been any sort of depth of analysis of examples like that that have come to interesting sort of legal casework where a decision has been sort of made or a perspective has been surfaced around the responsibility of system designers to demonstrate that due diligence.
Yeah, I think the problem is the law is so underdeveloped at the moment, and there's really so much that needs to be considered by the legal system, by judges. Yeah, I can't really point to anything that kind of narrows in on that. But yeah, judges are keenly aware of impacts of AI systems. They're considering matters like bias of systems. They're considering matters like transparency or the lack thereof in AI systems. Again, I'm sort of moving the conversation over to the realm of AI systems making decisions about us, right? That impact us, like whether it's do you get a bank loan? Do you get insurance coverage? Do you get a job? Do you get social assistance, these kinds of things? So yeah, that's the law has been developing, and for sure in that area, again, looking at these concerns around different kinds of harm, particularly bias, particularly transparency or the lack thereof, or explainability. And then sort of more into my comfort zone is privacy, because we look very much into the privacy impacts of AI systems, all different kinds of systems that can have a very profound impact on privacy, especially to the extent that these systems will collect information about us that may be, publicly available, but they're very, very powerful in terms of collecting anything that's out there, sort of scouring the web and getting information on, me and you, and questions around, well, should they be doing that in the first place? Should they be taking our information that sure is public, but is that something that we consented to, or even were we even notified that this is happening? And there have been some legal cases around that. You might know a little bit about this Clearview AI system company that had that their purpose was to really scrape the web and create personal profiles on literally billions of individuals and to use those to to monetize that. One of their initial angle was, well, let's make this available to law enforcement, so we can get photo matches and figure out who individuals are that might be wanted by the police, that kind of thing. But that really got into the whole idea, this fundamental problem of, we put our data out there. That's the world we live in, right? We put our pictures on Facebook and Instagram and various social media platforms. Does that mean it's fair game? And the
Love it.
at least in Canada, and I think around the world, data protection commissioners have said, no, that's not something that we reasonably expect or consent to. And this is offside again, even though it's publicly available, which I think some people have trouble with. It's like, well, your data's out there, so why can't companies, take advantage of that and innovate and do all kinds of cool things with it? Well, not so fast. Yes, is the legislation.
I love it, and I think privacy and privacy impact is a topic that is close to both of our hearts. That's probably my favorite thing to talk about. I like the sort of fact that this Clearview AI has gotten a lot of attention. I think even beyond just sort of the domain of, say, legal scholarship, because of how terrifying that is, right? The idea that this is wholesale profiling of general public, right? For uses that then might be, but I think your point is absolutely valid. If we look at the voluntary, let's say, provisioning of personal information in things like social media platforms, there's the elephant in the room is essentially how can we make a determination around what is informed consent, right? These third party use of data that is uploaded to social media platforms is very well documented in these completely unreadable terms of service. So what is the expectation from your perspective around how much is the responsibility of the individual to get educated on what the real risks are? So like how their data and the things that they upload could be used, versus how much of the responsibility should be placed on the platforms to make sure that users understand the risk landscape and the possible utilization of their personal information.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think your starting point is yes, it's fair to say that there should be a shared responsibility. You know, I as an individual do have some responsibility, you know, to be careful and make decisions. And you know, if I'm told, hey, you know, David, you can download this app, but we're gonna do this and that with your data, like, you know, I should be accountable for my choice, right? If I say, yeah, you know, I'm fine with that, I click yes, that's fine. But you know, one of the problems that I see is that unfortunately we live in a world where you kind of have to be online, and you kind of have to have a LinkedIn profile, for example, or you know, if you want to have a social life, right? To be especially younger people, you need to be on social media and you need to have that presence. So there's a little bit of, well, you have a choice, but you don't really. You know, if you want to sort of function well in society, but certainly shared responsibility. This is a fundamental problem that, you know, privacy experts have grappled with for many years, because the companies say, well, we give these notices to people. You know, David got that notice and he clicked yes after scrolling for 10 minutes because it was like a 200 page PDF or something. Well, we told him what was going to happen to his personal information. You know, that's not so great. And then, so then you get into other models of, well, does consent even really work? Kind of maybe nonsense in our age. And maybe what needs to happen is a little, it's a little more about, you know, companies need to act ethically. And there needs to be kind of ethical review of, you know, doing this, that, this, and this with people's data is reasonable and ethical, but there's a line. And then, you know, doing certain other things, well, not really ethical, and you shouldn't do that. And that, so again, not necessarily based on individual consent, but then that goes against the whole idea of, you know, we should be autonomous and making our own decisions about our own lives. So it's a real fundamental struggle. What is the right model? I don't know that there's any clear answers yet. Maybe it is a combination of consent versus ensuring organizations act in an ethical manner, whatever that means.
I'm struggling to remember. I remember coming across a really brilliant piece of research that put a very fine point on it, computed the based on average human reading speed, how long it actually would take just to read the terms of service of the applications on our mobile devices. And then again, like really painting a picture of the fact that we can't expect it's impossible to expect that people have actually even read, let alone comprehended, the terms of services that they are supposedly accepting and presumably in an informed manner. I found that quite, and I think it's exactly to your point that we've sort of rubber stamped the consent model and not done a great job as technologists, as companies, product companies, social media platforms, etc. Very excited about the value proposition, but haven't really educated users on the value proposition that they get in exchange for sharing that data against risks, right? So really this idea of educating users of things like social media platforms in terms of like the cost benefit analysis for them, right? Presumably we all want really great access to the best email service, the best social media platform, the ability to function effectively in a increasingly technology driven society, or like at least social communications. But at the same time, that risk landscape hasn't been articulated outside of these very inaccessible documents, I would argue. Let me ask maybe the question that's been on my mind. It's a bit of an elephant in the room question. So again, I don't know if you've got a different perspective. I've struggled a lot with, from a privacy perspective, knowing that fully trained machine learning or AI models can, and in some cases do, reveal information about that was contained within the corpus or corpora of data used to train those models. How do we feel this the sort of space of a fully trained ML model, something like a large language model that's incredibly expensive to train, interfaces with current privacy law around things like right for deletion, right to be excluded from particular data sets? I think it's a bit of a thorny question. It's one that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about and don't have a great answer for myself, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Wow. Yeah. Right to deletion, the right to be forgotten, as is talked about in Europe. Yeah, that's so interesting. I think, you know, maybe one of the points to talk about in this space is the idea of de-identification, anonymization, so that, sure, maybe your data is used and you may not want that, but it may be used in a way that, well, it has turned from your personal information to not your personal information, if you know what I mean. Like it's stripped of identifiers, or there's this fascinating tool called synthetic data, where your data is actually used to create data that's not even real, but has the kind of the qualities of the original data. So there are all kinds of you know, privacy enhancing technologies like de-identification, anonymization, synthetic data that can, I think, alleviate some of those concerns for people who are saying, well, I don't want you to use my data for that purpose to train that model. Mm-hmm. So maybe there is a win. There's a win in terms of we can create models that are effective, that rely on good data, but at the same time, we're not harming privacy as much as we might otherwise with the use of these kinds of tools.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good, and it's nice to be very specific in the language. So I think there's a difference between simply the right to have your data excluded from a database, which I think we have pretty good coverage in Canada, I think in the European jurisdiction as well, around how that's handled, right? So there's a very clear mechanism for, you know, under GDPR, for example, where I can ask for visibility into data that is personally identifiable to me, portability of that, deletion of that. And I think when we get into what is the status of the trained model that included data about myself, so personally identifiable information, whether that's any kind of let's say tabular data around myself, unique identifiers, but also things like photographs, videos that contain my likeness, I think that becomes a bit of a more nuance. But I like the perspective that there's even above and beyond the right to have, or the sort of ambiguity around how do you handle requests for deletion or exclusion. Then there's also this: what is my autonomy? What are my rights as an individual to determine what that is used for. Maybe I will object to one use but not another, and subscribe to the value proposition that by allowing an organization to process my data in a particular way, there is an upside for me in terms of things like personalized services, or efficiency gains for myself. But I may have a conscientious objection to things, for example, my facial likeness being used as part of a military application, just as an example. And so I think we enter into like two sort of possible concerns for the consumer. For and here I mean like, consumer AI products, in terms of what is our right to determine what is done with our data downstream from collection. Do you have any perspective on that or how that's evolving in the space of more and more use of this data in AI systems?
Yeah, no, this is fascinating. And you go back to first principles of privacy legislation, and first principles would say, fundamentally, we all have a right to determine what happens to our information, the information about us. Starting with, is it even collected in the first place? How is it used? Is it used in ways that we agree with or don't agree with? But there are always compromises, and often what happens is you have a clash of principles. Sure, I have to some extent a right to self-determination, but at the same time, when it comes to, for example, information about my health, which is very sensitive, I mean, there are societal values that say, health research is fundamentally important for society. And to some extent, I may not even have a choice whether my data can be used in health research. Again, because of the overriding societal interest in advancing the health of our population. So it's fascinating. And how do you, I like your idea, but how do you implement that? Like, oh, I want, yes.
No,
You can use my image for some of these. Here's a list of good things, but here's a list of bad things. Don't use my image for these bad things. I mean, again, fundamentally, I'd say that's fine. That should be, my wishes should be respected, but maybe only to the point where, what is the cost of that
oh, man.
to society, to organizations, to society?
I think you've actually answered it, and it's not an angle that I've sort of thought about, but and again, coming back to privacy first principles and how that applies to the current conversation around the AI space is indeed what is the difference between what we claim to value as a society, so these societal values, and the paradox with how people actually behave. Right. And we've seen that in terms of the way that people will consent to data collection with, even when it may conflict with what we claim are like sort of private, like these fundamental societal value around the right to privacy. And then yet people do post pictures of their children on social media, pictures of themselves on social media, have conversations in what is, for all intents and purposes, a public venue. On for particular platforms, in spite of the fact that we do claim to really hold sacred this idea of privacy. I think that that's really connected to that sort of last topic, which is how do we resolve, and it's a big open question, I would say, how do we resolve the paradox between the things that we claim to value as a society and the fact that folks behave often in a very different and very contradictory manner, especially around consumer technologies.
Wow, yeah. People aren't always rational actors. That's the whole idea of being human is we don't always, act in a consistent manner. So yeah, how do you resolve that's a tough one, and because you're right, we've got these sort of over potentially overriding societal values, but we want people to have that autonomy to make their own decisions. So how do you resolve, I guess what we're we'll go back to AI regulation, right? Because it's kind of what we're talking about. And, you know, we see regulation starting to happen in a pretty big way all around the world, Canada, US, UK, Europe, and other places. I guess what's most fundamental here is that everyone who has kind of a stake in this needs to be at the table and designing this regulation. It's just really important to get diverse perspectives, because there are going to be perspectives that some may not even think of. The government may not even hadn't even thought of that kind of thing. So you got to have governments at the table, industry experts, civil society organizations, academia, marginalized communities, global representation. All of these things, I think, matter and help to at least can help us shape regulation in a way that perhaps does balance societal values with individual autonomy and individual, you know, our the messy ways that we act as humans.
I love it. No, I think you're absolutely spot on that indeed participation is the key. Folks have a responsibility to participate, and in that sort of regulatory development, that conversation, the only thing I would add, and that in order to foster that participatory, participation of things like marginalized communities, non-technical and technical stakeholders, legal scholars, academics, etc., is indeed a constant push on education. So equipping people to be able to participate in that conversation, creating a space where they're welcome, but also equipped to have that dialogue. And I think that's our shared responsibility.
Very, very important point. I totally agree.
Awesome. Thank you so much, David. It's been phenomenal.
It has. We could go on for another hour, I'm sure, but this has been great.
This has been The Resonance Test, a podcast from EPAM Continuum. EPAM Continuum integrates business, experience, and technology consulting focused on accelerating breakthrough ideas into meaningful impact. Why do we do this? Because real opportunities aren't siloed. David Gudis, thank you so much for joining us. Martin Lapatka was our interviewer. Cheers to Kip Palalis, our sound engineer extraordinaire, for getting this podcast recorded. Applause to Ken Gordon, our producer, for all his masterminding behind the scenes. I'm your host, Allison Coden. Now it's 10 p.m. Do you know where your data is?